Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen. Brian is off today. And now we turn to the latest in COVID-19 news in New York City, as the city sees a 32% increase in new cases. According to the latest data from the health department, the likely cause in the spike comes from a combination of the highly contagious Delta variant and new data which shows that 6 out of the 10 New York City zip codes with the highest positivity rates this past week had less than 50% vaccination rates. Joining me now to talk about the latest news and what can be done to increase New York City's vaccination rates are S. Mitra Kalita, co-founder of URL Media and the CEO and publisher of Epicenter NYC, and Harlem Gunness, the director of public health at St. John's University. Professor Gunness, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor.
And Mitra, welcome back.
Hi, Bridget. It's so great to be back. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to dig into this news with both of you. And unfortunately, it shows that 6 out of the 10 New York City zip codes with the highest positivity rates this past week had less than 50% vaccination rates. Mitra, what neighborhoods are we looking at here?
Sure. So in Brooklyn, Cypress Hills and East New York had the most new COVID cases in New York City. That's from data ending on July 7th, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then really significantly, though, is that of the top 6, 4 of the top COVID rates are in Staten Island. That's mm-hmm. mostly on the South Shore of Staten Island, which, I've been on the show for a few months now talking about mm-hmm. vaccines, and this is an area we've been concerned about for a few reasons, but the South Shore of Staten Island is among the most disconnected parts of New York City. So even early in the vaccine rollout, we were getting calls at Epicenter from folks in these communities that might not be near a mega site, might not be near a subway, might not be near bus lines. And so, unfortunately, the least vaccinated parts of New York are indeed where we're seeing these surges. Hmm.
Professor Gunness, do you want to weigh in a bit on why certain zip codes are still below the citywide vaccination rate? You know, are we talking about access to a vaccine, or is it really vaccine skepticism, or is it a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, when you look at the neighborhoods with the low vaccination rates, you're seeing that it's almost mirrors the neighborhoods with, when we look at it a year ago, with high infection rate or high mortality rate. For instance, in Far Rockaway, about a year mm-hmm. ago, it had one of the highest mortality rates in the city due to COVID. When you look at the vaccination rates now, it's less than 40% for those who are fully vaccinated. It's significantly way behind that compared to other communities in New York City. And I think that there's a lot of things that are going on here in these communities. It's not an issue of having a mega site. I think, there's a lot of hesitancies. There's a lot of history behind these communities in terms of mm-hmm. Historical events that led to mistrust in the community, lack of information, health literacy, access to information, education, access to subject matter experts that understand the community and convey the message to the community in a manner in which the community would understand it. There's a lot of things in terms of when you look at the operational aspect of the vaccination programs. Are they really sending the message that the community needs to hear? Are they making? Do they have tailored health education campaigns? Do they have the sites that are open and during the hours when the community is available?
Hmm.
So these are some examples.
Lots of issues at play. Focusing a little bit more on Staten Island, we saw that the city's 7-day positivity average rose from 0.63% last Monday, July 5th, to 0.91% on Sunday. Staten Island's 7-day rate is 1.42%, making it the highest in the city. you know, Mitra or Professor Gunness, it's been a few weeks of lower positivity rates around the city. What happened this past week? What explains this this increase?
So I think it's important when your listeners hear percentages, I think it's important to note that in some of these cases, we're talking about like dozens, right? So the highest, for example, sure. in East New York is 33 cases. And I share that because in a community like this area of Staten Island, you might have blended families, you might have, you know, the son living in the basement or a two-family house or something like that. And so one family can have a significant increase on the rate. And that, I think, and especially if you have unvaccinated households, as the statistics are bearing out, can be very significant. On the other hand, even if you take that aside, New York City is a city unleashed right now. I mean, I feel like the minute that the mask guidance changed, you know, you really just started seeing people not just out and about, but like in full force. And so I think we're seeing some of that coming to bear in these unfortunate statistics. You know, it was the 4th of July weekend might have contributed. The data is still early on that, and we'll see what next week brings. But it was a pretty rainy 4th of July weekend. And so I think that drove people indoors. And the last thing I'll say, and I'd love Dr. Gunness's perspective on this too, but, you know, this moment feels like one of the most confusing times to navigate COVID, right? Some places have mask policies, others do not. There are still a significant portion of the population that are not vaccinated, and that's not a choice. I'm including my own household in that. I have a daughter who's 9 years old. And so there is this, I don't know. I think it's almost the perfect storm where mask guidance is confusing. You still have a significant portion of the population that's unvaccinated, not all by choice. And you have the growth of the variants, specifically the Delta variant that you mentioned. And so that's all converging to create these rates. And, you know, my question now is, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to continue to be a city going about to quote unquote normal times, or are we going to solve for the reality of many of our communities that are either still not vaccinated, can't be vaccinated, live in dense households, might have jobs where they're interfacing with many folks and don't have the privilege of only, you know, being in a bubble.
Professor Gunness, what is your take on it? I mean, it was striking to me even just over this past weekend, listening to our likely Democratic mayoral nominee, Eric Adams, as he was on the national television circuit, get asked about would he support mask guidance for people who are indoors, similar to what I believe Los Angeles is continuing to do. And he said he would. And so, you know, that is, of course, runs in conflict to the actual guidance given by our current mayor and others in charge of managing the pandemic right now. What is your take on what Mitra was just describing in terms of how this may, in fact, be one of the most confusing moments in the pandemic?
Yes, absolutely. And just to add to Mitra's point, I think that, you know, when you look at what's the behavior of this virus or the behavior of the pandemic, there's so many variables and there's so many moving parts and changes that are occurring. And I think that if we haven't already gotten used to these, you know, changes that are happening briefly on a weekly basis or a daily basis as new science comes out or new information is available to us. So I think that, you know, right now, you know, we heard that CDC, I think, early this weekend, they talked about a booster vaccine. They talked about, you know, wearing mask and in public or the need to not wear mask. But it becomes very confusing, I think, you know, for New Yorkers because, you know, although we have 70% of us who are vaccinated, some of us may not be vaccinated. We, you know, as New Yorkers, we have lots of tourists that that visit. A lot of people that are coming back and forth from different states, so we don't know and can't confirm who is actually vaccinated from who's not vaccinated, and we don't have we don't have policing in that sense, nor do we need it necessarily. But I think that there's so many factors that play into the Delta variant as well. You know, we know that it is spreading much faster, almost 2 times as fast as the Alpha variant. And we also know that, you know, with a new variant like the Delta, it will accelerate the spread of disease. It becomes much more infectious. So there could be many factors that that may have been going on in Staten Island. I know that last year around this time, during the pandemic, when I was in Staten Island, and this is anecdotally, I was having lunch in Breezy Point, and people were going on with their daily lives and their daily business with no mask, and this was at the peak of the virus where. Government officials and public health authorities were advising that we wear masks and socially distance. That was not occurring for my 2 hours that I spent there. Again, that's anecdotally. So I don't know what are the behaviors and the perception of those in Staten Island that may, you know, play a role in terms of their behavior that may put them at risk. I'm reading also that politics may play a role as well. So I don't know if that has an association with those who live in Staten Island versus those who live in other places in the city.
Sure. And of course, Breezy Point on the Rockaway Peninsula, just across the water from our friends in Staten Island. But listeners, I'm wondering if any of you out there recently decided to get vaccinated against COVID. And, you know, why did you come around now? Or maybe have you recently convinced a friend or a family member to get the vaccine? Tell us what worked. Tweet at Brian Lehr or give us a call now at 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. We're going to go to a caller who has been on the show before. Mark, I believe it's Dr. Horowitz, a family physician in Manhattan. Mark, welcome back to WNYC.
Bridget, thank you for having me, and it's so great to hear you pinch hitting for Brian. My esteemed colleagues who are on the air with you have raised some very important points, and my highly esteemed and good friend Mitra has in particular made some really great points.
Hi, Dr. Horowitz.
Hi, Mitra. So let me relate to you my own experience as a primary care physician in Manhattan who was allocated pretty much an unlimited amount of vaccine by the Department of Health in early March, and I still have an adequate supply of both the Johnson & Johnson and Moderna vaccine. The people who we have termed vaccine, quote-unquote, hesitant, have for the most part come down off the fence and received the vaccine. They've had their concerns addressed, their doubts addressed. They've come around to understand that the vaccine is safe, it's effective, and it's done so much to highly impact the prevalence of the virus in our community. What we are seeing now, and when I say now, I mean over the last, say, 4 to 6 weeks, are the vaccine refusers. We are seeing people who come in, and we ask every patient who comes into the office whether they've received the vaccine, and if they say no, we ask if they want to receive the vaccine. When they decline the vaccine, we enter into a real open-minded, non-judgmental, non-shaming discussion with them and ask them what their reasons are. And unfortunately, what I'm finding are four categories of what I would call bizarre, misinformed, or frankly delusional reasons that people have for not receiving the vaccine. Everything from it's not FDA approved and it was rushed to the market, to concerns about the vaccine on their fertility or other long-term effects. We also get people saying that, and I just had one a half an hour ago, a young man whose father has coronary artery disease. He's a patient of mine as well. But he declines to get the vaccine because he feels, quote unquote, my immune system is strong enough. I don't need the vaccine. And finally, we get people, and a fairly significant number of people, who believe because they've had COVID, they remain immune to the virus in all of its forms, variations, and manifestations. So these are all really misinformed rationale. In some cases, people offer fairly delusional or bizarre theories, which I suspect they've read in some dark corner of the internet. And they're pretty steadfast in their refusal. They say, "Doc, thanks for your discussion, but I'm simply not going to get it." And, you know, obviously to me, who believes very, very strongly that the vaccine is saving lives and helping us return to normal, it's a bit frustrating. But I think that
Well, I just wonder, Dr. Horwitz, since you have both identified these different types of individuals who are, refusing to get the vaccine, I'm wondering if you feel that you yourself have not been able to persuade them, do you get a sense of what is persuasive to them? Is there an individual, are they expecting to read something or learn something, or do you get any sense of what might start to help change their mind? Now, obviously, if you could change their mind, you would, but wondering, if you get a sense of, what the thing is that could help start pushing them in another direction.
I have two answers to that question, both of which I've thought out at great length. The first is, and I'm a great believer in individual freedom, but this is not about individual freedom. This is about, the average person with COVID is highly infectious before he or she starts manifesting symptoms of the disease. So that person is spreading the virus to other people before they become sick. So I think what's going to have to happen in the future, and a lot of my patients work in Lower Manhattan, haven't come back to the workplace yet, but are coming back to the workplace in early September. I think there will need to be workplace mandates. I really do. And as hard as that is for those of us who are in favor of civil liberties, that's going to be a necessary factor. People are going to be at risk of losing their jobs if they're not vaccinated. But frankly, I don't want to be sitting at a desk next to an unvaccinated individual. I think that the Houston Methodist case really lends tremendous legal support to the notion of workplace mandates. Of course, we have to give people religious and medical exemptions. But, if you're working in a workplace where there are other people close to you, you need to get the vaccine. I also think that social gatherings, concerts, sporting events, restaurants, I think we're going to start needing to examine whether people need to be vaccinated in order to be present at those locations. It's hard to imagine requiring it. There are some venues, Bruce Springsteen comes to mind. There are some venues where vaccination is required. And I think as more and more venues require vaccination, I think the FOMO, the fear of missing out, may convince some people to vaccinate. Now, here in New York City and among my patient population, I don't think there are a lot of political reasons for refusing the vaccine. But frankly, I've often thought if the man who shall remain nameless but used to sit in the Oval Office got on TV and said, "I want all of my supporters to get vaccinated," I think a good number of people will line up and get vaccinated, maybe not in New York City, but in other places in the United States.
Dr. Horwitz, thank you. Thank you so much for your call and perspective. A lot for our guests to chew on. Mitra, I know you know Dr. Horwitz. Any initial reaction to some of the issues he raised?
Well, we've been keeping in touch with both Dr. Horwitz and Dr. Gunnis, who is on with me, just so that our both journalism as well as our efforts to help the community are grounded in current reality. And so it's great to hear kind of that distilling of the four characteristics, which I had not heard from him before. So I think that's great guidance. I think one trend we're seeing, because we're obviously working to still get folks vaccinated, I agree that the hesitant are switching, but I think we need to almost take the refusers, get them on a path to the hesitants, and then get them vaccinated. So there's a way to flip the script, which now it takes weeks. And I think that's where government doing things the way they've been doing it just does not work anymore. So organizations like ours, for example, will get calls saying, my daughter refuses to get vaccinated. Can you help me? And then we begin the process of saying, why are they refusing? And so let's say it's you know, as Dr. Horowitz pointed out, a medical issue. We say, well, do you want to talk to a doctor? And Dr. Horowitz might be the doctor I call that they can talk to. But what I think we're definitely sensing from the last few weeks of helping maybe about a dozen people or so in this situation is that it has to be somebody they know who's doing the approach, married mm-hmm. to expertise. The expertise might mm-hmm. be a medical professional, but it also might be a member of the clergy. I just had a woman who's from the Sikh community, right, the Indian religion, and she asked, is there somebody from a gurdwara, that's their place of worship, who might speak to the guardian of a family? And so we're coordinating that process right now. She doesn't mm-hmm. really care about talking to a medical expert. She's mm-hmm. concerned about her faith and what it says about vaccines. And so you really do need to do this pretty intricate matchmaking to get the vaccine refusers into the camp of hesitant but willing to listen, and then ultimately we hope vaccinated. That is a weeks, maybe months long process.
Well, I want to bring in a caller who I think is going to share a story of going through a similar process. Sharon Gutenberg, Sharon from New Jersey, from Gutenberg, New Jersey, excuse me.
Yes.
Welcome to WNYC. Can you tell us your story?
Thank you. I really was very, very hesitant to take the vaccine. And recently I have a coworker who contracted COVID-19. And, it scared me. He had the vaccine and I was very nervous that, you know, why even bother? He got the vaccine. Then within 3 days, another coworker also got COVID. Unfortunately, he was not vaccinated and he's been hospitalized now for over 2 weeks. And the difference in the two coworkers really convinced me that even if you do still get the, you know, contract COVID, the recovery was so short and so speedy. He had no side effects. He really just was home on bed rest.
And it
really hit home to me that the vaccine works.
Wow. And so you decided to get your vaccine.
So I decided that myself and my 16-year-old daughter should get the vaccine, and we did like 5 days ago.
Sharon, well, thank you so much for sharing your story. We have another caller with a different type of story. Jeremy in Gramercy, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And what's your story with vaccinations?
So basically, I was vaccinated very early, but then I grew up in the Midwest. My family still lives there. So I was back visiting about a month or so ago. And my mother was very skeptical of getting the vaccine, had a lot of misinformation about it. Basically, what I did was just kind of reframe it for her in the fact that she's eligible to get the vaccine and her granddaughter is not. And so I'm like, you're putting her at risk, and kind of framed it like that. Like, what if you got COVID and somehow gave it to her, how would that make you feel? And then after that, really kind of made her brain start thinking, like, maybe I should think about it. And then we kind of just went over all the science. Like, she had a lot of misinformation from social media. So we just kind of like went through that, debunked it, found like reputable sources to get the information that proves those things wrong.
Jeremy, thank you so much for sharing your story. Professor Gunnis, since the number of deaths have gone down in the city and more people are getting vaccinated, the sense of urgency around testing seems to have gone down. Can testing and the infrastructure we've built around it since the pandemic began still be used to help combat the Delta variant?
Yes, absolutely. But I think we need more targeted and strategic approach, similar to what needs to occur with vaccination. So what I mean when I say that is that, we know that with the Delta variant, it's highly infectious, much more infectious than the Alpha, as well as it's accelerating the spread of the disease. We also know that there are gaps in the city, and there are areas with low vaccination rates. So we may find that there may be sort of pockets in, you know, within the cities where we're seeing the infection occurring at a rapid pace, as well as the severity of the disease and or death due to those who are not vaccinated. So I think, you know, it, just listening to what Mitra said and Dr. Horwitz said, I hope I pronounce his name right, you know, I think that we really need to hone in on the issues that are happening in the communities that are not vaccinated. So I'll stick with Far Rockaway for an as an example, because I studied Far Rockaway and I've also published about the issues in Far Rockaway. I think that what really needs to occur is we really need to have a sort of education and outreach, or for lack of a better word, a dog and pony show, where we have all the bells and whistles. You know, it's not just about pop-up sites. It's about really getting connected with the leaders in the community, having all the announcements and the language and the literacy so that the community understands this. You know, I think someone referenced about really, you know, when you communicate about the purpose or the benefit of vaccination, how does that benefit you and your loved ones? So it's not about, you know, it's not about you necessarily, but your granddaughter. If you get vaccinated, then you can protect your granddaughter who lives with you. So it's really about really trying to deliver these messages so that the communities understand it. A lot of communities may have single moms or grandmothers taking care of kids. You know, there may be religious beliefs. Connecting with the religious leaders, we see that this is working. It has worked in South Jamaica, and I do believe it can work in other places as well. Do we have the resources to pull it together? We're learning that as much as we have mega sites for vaccination, we may not have the resources to go into these pockets of the communities where there is a low vaccination rate, connect with the community leaders, bring in the resources, bring in the education, bring in the information, and you know, to share with them. It's about also the pop-up sites. We're seeing that pop-up sites may not be as effective as brick-and-mortar sites that have an existing relationship in the community. You know, so these are a lot of factors to consider when we think of, you know, variants. But I think that the great thing is that we have a system already in place. Let's build on it and let's do more targeted and more focused strategic planning.
Professor Gunnis, we have another caller on the line we're not going to be able to get to because we're running out of time. But to summarize her question, you know, she says it's premature to say there are no long-term consequences to taking the vaccine. What can you say to put people like this caller at ease in terms of long-term effects of the COVID vaccines?
That's an excellent question. And with all vaccines, we know that there may be I think with all vaccines, we know that it serves a perfect purpose in protecting our immunity and protecting our health. To answer the question, the mRNA vaccine has been studied for decades. It's a familiar, well-known vaccine among scientists. The studies have shown over and over again the data, the research, that it's proven to be effective, and it causes you know, severe side effects for a very, very small number of people. So when we hear a lot about, you know, a side effect of the vaccine, the J&J or any other vaccines that it may cause, it's just always remember it's a very small number of individuals. So as the year we get more data and the years progress, we're going to see the impact, the benefit of the vaccine. What we don't know, what concerns us, I think, as researchers and scientists, is whether or not the vaccine, how long it will last in our system, and how much immunity it's going to provide as different variants may emerge from the COVID-19. And I think that's a concern to me and I think to a lot of the public health community. But I think we have to sort of stick with what we have now. And what we have now is a vaccine that is really working, and we're seeing the difference that it's making. And we're also seeing the difference, what's happening for those who are not vaccinated, where you have like a 99% of those who die are those who are not vaccinated, which is really telling that, you know, the vaccination is really effective and it's working. And I really don't think that, I think that that's, going back to Dr. Horwitz's comment, I think that, you know, adding to his comment, one of the concerns that, that I hear, because I've developed the fact sheet to debunk the myths, and one of the things that I'm hearing when we did a qualitative assessment of the information on the fact sheet is people really want to hear what's the difference between the expedited emergency vaccine development versus the FDA sort of traditional 2 to 5 year development process. So they really want that information, and they want it to be broken down very simply, so they know that it has gone through the all the checks and all the, you know, the testing and what is required for the vaccine to be safe. That was one of the biggest concerns in all the different languages that we tested.
So much more to talk about here. We could keep going on, I know, and so grateful to have both of you join us today. My guests have been S. Mitra Kalita, co-founder of URL Media and CEO and publisher of Epicenter NYC, and Harlem Gunnis, the director of public health at St. John's University. Mitra and Dr. Gunnis, thank you both so much. Clearly a lot more to keep talking about in the days and weeks ahead.
You're welcome, Bridget.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.